Today is Friday, June 28th, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Vítor Vesztele, continuing his series of on the cross. Today's session is number 5 and is entitled, Were You There When They Crucified My Lord? The Practice of Resurrection. Let's listen in.
For those of you who are here for the first time, my name is Vítor Vesztele. I come from Brazil, and I have been teaching for the last years in Chicago at the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago. And we are now in the 5th session on the theology of the cross. Just a brief summary of what we have seen in the previous weeks, in the previous days during this week. We started discussing the way in which the cross has been domesticated and the way in which the cross has been has turned into, from a scandal to the first Christians, has turned itself into an idol. And I express this saying that it became a sort of an easy answer instead of a troubling question. And I was trying to I was thinking about the cross more as an interrogation mark, and then I was thinking about some crucifix that you see when you see the person hanging on the cross and with the dead already, with the head bowed down and the legs in this position. The image that comes to mind really is of an interrogation, right, and not an exclamation. And I think that's a nice indication of the way in which we should be considering, or we should be regarding the cross more as an interrogation mark than as an exclamation. We move from there to the criticisms that have been raised in modern theology to this interpretation of the cross as entailing in principle as soteriological, that means a salvific meaning in and of itself. And the criticisms to the different ways in which the cross has been interpreted has been that on one side it does not relate the cross to our own lives, but it seems to be something that hangs on the air, and it's a negotiation between God and God's self through God's own Son, but doesn't involve humanity as such. And the other criticism is that it tends to perpetuate a sort of a cult of suffering, a devotion to suffering, instead of seeing suffering as a means and not as an end. We move from there to the way in which the cross, the theology of the cross, has had a comeback in the recent decades, in the 2 or 3 last decades, a comeback in the sense that the discussion around the cross shifted from seeing it as a ready-made answer to the problems that we have, as an answer to the question of our salvation, to being really a question about our own existence. A shift that also implies a move from the understanding of the cross as an event that took place in Palestine in the year 33 or so, to the understanding that this cross that we know of, the cross of Jesus, is the one that points to the crosses in our everyday life. The cross of oppression, of discrimination, the cross of suffering, of sickness, the situations in life in which we cannot really account for the sources of the suffering that overcome people. Yesterday we saw, as the 4th part in this sequence, we saw 4 possible responses to the cross, depending on one's location over against the cross. And I talked about that spiritual that asks, were you there when they crucified my Lord, right? And if you are there, where were you? And we rehearsed four possibilities looking at the biblical scenario, and we saw that some people run from the cross, like the disciples, for example. While other disciples, who happened to be the women, they stood at the foot of the cross. Others were there at the foot of the cross, but they were trying to see a miracle happening there instead of seeing the passion and the suffering that was taking place. They were asking for the physician to cure himself, right? Or for the Son of God to step down from the cross, or for Elijah to come and help Jesus. So they were trying to see the sign of something marvelous on that which was not marvelous at all, on that which was really a mark and a stigma of a question that did not have at that point any answer. And then the fourth possibility, or the fourth I didn't say the first. The first one would be to be on the cross itself, which was the case of Jesus, was the case of those thousands of people that were crucified by being accused of being rebels within the Roman Empire, political subversives within the Roman Empire. The fourth position over against vis-a-vis the cross was those of the one of the women. The women that stood there, and I like that poem by Barry that I read yesterday, and just a reminder, one of the verses of the poem says, who does not tremble, who does not fear at the darkness of the sixth hour? Unless we cry like Mary at the foot of the cross, giving him as lost, no Easter morning comes or is going to come. And I think that's the crucial aspect to understand the position of the women that were there, the women that saw their beloved one being killed, and they didn't expect anything else. They didn't really expect, and there is no indication that they would expect any miraculous event as the others that were crying out for Jesus to step down from the cross or for Elijah to help me. They were there in a labor of mourning. In a labor of mourning that took them from the time of the crucifixion to the early morning of Easter, took them to prepare ointment and spices to perfume the body of the one who they loved without any meaning in it. Without any meaning except the one that there was a deep confidence, and I think that's the definition of faith, was a deep confidence that no act of love will ever be lost. And I think that was the confidence of the women that were practicing what I call the practice of resurrection, and it's about that I would like to speak a bit about today. In the last sessions, I had some people coming to me and telling me some stories about the cross, and we haven't had the chance to share them in a larger group, so I would really encourage you to try to tell your own stories if you feel like doing it. Tell your own stories about what the cross really means in your life and the ways in which you have been faced or on the cross itself. The practice of resurrection, I'll read to you another poem, you might know it. It's a very well known piece by Wendell Berry again. And it's there where I took the expression, the practice of resurrection, to say what I want to say today. This poem is called The Manifesto, The Mad Farmer Liberation Front. So Dan knows it. Do you, Dan? Wendell Berry writes, love the quick profit, the annual raise, vacation with pay, want more of everything ready-made, be afraid to know your neighbor and to die, and you'll have a window in your head. Not even your future will be a mystery anymore. Your mind will be punched in a cart and shut away in a little drawer. When they want you to buy something, they will call you. When they want you to die for profit, they will let you know. No, friends. Every day do something that won't compute. Love the Lord. Love the world. Work for nothing. Take all that you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Denounce the government and embrace the flag. Hope to live in that free republic for which it stands. Give your approval to all you cannot understand. Praise ignorance for what man has not encountered, he has not destroyed. Ask the questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant, that you will not leave to harvest. Say that the leaves are harvested when they have rotted into the mold. Call that profit. Prophesy such returns. Put your faith in 2 inches of humus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Listen to carrion. Put your ear close and hear the faint chattering of songs that are to come. Expect the end of the world. Laugh. Laughter is immeasurable. Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts. So long as women do not go cheap for power, please women more than men. Ask yourself, will this satisfied a woman satisfied to bear a child? Will this disturb the sleep of a woman near to giving birth? Go with your love to the fields. Lie easily in the shade. Rest your head in her lap. Swear allegiance to what is nighest your thoughts. As soon as the generals and the politicos can predict the motion of your mind, lose it. Leave it as a sign to mark the false trail, the way you didn't go. Be like the fox who makes more tracks than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Practice resurrection. This poem reminded me of one of the most important books that I read when I started to become interested in theology. Was actually a book on literature. Was written by a German who was in prison during the Nazi period, and he didn't have any book available to himself. He wrote it all of his own memories, quoting from all the early Western literature, from Greek mythology to Virginia Woolf. And it was just a survey of Western literature, including the Bible. His name is Erich Auerbach, and the name of the book is Nemesis. I don't know if you are familiar with that. It's really a book on literature, and one of the striking things that this guy writes about is that in the whole of Western literature, he says the Bible is unique. And it is unique because for the first time in Western literature, you are going to find that the main actors in literature is not the nobility, are not the heroes, but are going to be the fishermen, the peasants, women, people of low classes that frequently are the protagonists of the biblical stories. And I was struck by that because he says, well, this is not only one of the characteristics of the biblical literature, that's what makes it unique. And what makes it unique, he says, it's also the fact that there is a constant reversal in the Bible. When you see the most despised thing, there is where you can expect to see the epiphany of God, the manifestation of God's power. When you see slavery, you read liberation. When you see sickness, you read also healing. When you see poverty, you see wealth, richness. And so all these reversals that characterize, according to Auerbach, the biblical literature as literature, and he is not writing from any theological standpoint. When you see that that happening, it says that you are, then you know you are facing something very special, a different kind of literature. And this has been very influential to me, because I think that this this reversal and this understanding that in the depth of the human condition, that there is where the presence of God is going to be made manifest, in the very depth of the human condition. That's what the theology of the cross, I think, is all about. It's about these reversals that out of the nothingness, out of that sheer negation that happens in the cross, something new, something totally new, out of nothing, as we saw yesterday, out of nothing, something is going to be made. Something is going to come. So that poem by Barry that I read yesterday, I think guts it very clearly. Unless we cry, we weep like Mary, giving him as lost, no Easter morning is going to come. What I'd like to talk to you today about in relationship to the practice of resurrection is actually the relationship between the cross and the resurrection. I have already made mention a number of times to some of the controversies regarding the theology of the cross that tries to use the theology of the cross as a contextual form of theology, but contextual in the sense that it is restricted to certain conditions. And I gave two examples, two opposite examples. One is Douglas John Hall, the Canadian theologian, who says, well, the theology of the cross really is not for the people that are on the cross, is not for the crucified people, are not for those who are suffering, but is exactly for those who are the thieves, not for those who have fallen among the thieves. And on the other side, the African-American pastor, the Reverend Youngblood, which says, well, in our situation, we cannot use the cross, only the resurrection. And I gave the example of this stained glass window in his church that he designed, in which this African-American Jesus breaking up the shackles in his hands and breaking apart, splitting into pieces a cross that was standing in front of him. I think that this way of understanding the cross leads to what we have been seeing here, also leads to a form of a dualism in which you are going to separate humanity or society in two groups of people, one that is purely in need of the word of resurrection without any cross on it, and the other in which you need some cross and there is no promise, there is no resurrection. I think the way in which we ought to be reading the question of the theology of the cross, or the issues concerning the theology of the cross, is to see that these two sides of the issue, the resurrection, the affirmation of life, happens not out in a vacuum, but happens exactly when we recognize and when we see the crosses in the world in which we live. We can break up the cross once we have recognized that that's the condition. And we can also celebrate the resurrection without falling into what Douglas John Hall calls resurrectionism, or what he calls the culture of official optimism. And that's his reading of the North American condition. We have a culture of optimism, of official optimism. He said, that lends itself to an over-evaluation of the resurrection over the cross. And I think the way in which he describes, I think it's correct. But the resurrection is always there, and is and can only be there once the power, once the situation of the cross empowers people to raise themselves over and above the condition of oppression and of discrimination, suffering, and pain, and so forth. So the cross is first and foremost a word of condemnation. Is that the question mark that I was talking about? Is that which says, what's the meaning of that? It's Job's question, right? That's what the cross raises. Why is that happening? Why have you forsaken me? This is the word of condemnation that the cross has. And I think Hall here is right. It needs to be announced, and it needs to be brought to the attention of the public. It needs to be brought to public attention, because only when we raise the question, why is that happening, do we start to locate the sources, the powers that engender the crosses in the world. We might not know it from the start, but when we start to name the reality of the cross, when we start to say it, as Luther said, the theologian of the cross says things as they are, names things as they are. In this naming of things, the powers start to tremble, because they recognize that they are eventually going to be also held responsible for that which happened. I think that's what was behind Paul's mind when in 2 Corinthians, in the second chapter, when he says that, let me read here, 2:7-8, says, so now instead you should... it's not 2 Corinthians, 1 Corinthians. In his discussion of the theology of the cross there, he says, but we speak God's wisdom, secret and hidden, which God decreed before the ages for our glory. None of the rulers of this age understood this. For if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. If they would know the power that was in that cross, when people will start to name that cross, they would not have done that. They would be wiser than that. So there is a way in which the suffering that's caused returns or goes back or points back to those who have engendered it. So this is the first aspect of the cross. It's the question that asks, what is happening in that, and why is this suffering there? What is the root of that suffering? What's the cause that has brought it about? And this is a question that often doesn't have any answer. It doesn't need to have an answer, but it needs to be named. It needs to be said. So it implies that we can clearly recognize that powers are there that create injustices, that create suffering, and so forth. Even if these powers cannot be traced to an entity like the state, like Rome, like the empire, like the U.S. government or anything, it might be traceable back to God, to God's own self, like Catherine of Siena said in that famous passage I read yesterday, the day before. My father, like a loving yet hurt God, looking threatening at me, and should he stretch out both his hands, God against God, save me, my Jesus, whom I follow from this arm. Save me, save me from my father and from his love, from his tyranny. So it's Job's question as well. When you cannot, you can, and you are able even to say it or to trace it back to God's own self. So this is the first aspect of the cross, is the capability of naming that which, that pain that lies inside and is so corrosive, is burning inside. However, the cross has also the other meaning associated with it, or the other aspect and hidden meaning. One could say the gospel in the cross, the gospel in what appears to be on the manifest side, on the outward side, pure condemnation. And this is what is presented in the story of the women that I talked about yesterday. Taking Mary's suggestion, we can say that the cross, her own experience from the conception of Jesus through her standing in face of the cross, that the cross is the expression of that utter pain, but at the same time, that which prompts her to show in acts of love what doesn't make much sense. That's what I call the labor of mourning. The labor of mourning, the invisible aspect of what the cross produces. On the 3 days on the 3 days of emptiness from the Friday to Easter, it's interesting that there are only the women as protagonists of the Christian story, right? From Friday to Easter morning, the women are there. The story is the story of the women that carry the Christian narrative from the day in which the powers seem to be victorious to the Easter morning, when the proclamation of the resurrection is made. The cross, the response to the cross of this, from this woman, is this labor of mourning in which they go home and they prepare spices and ointment for a body that would not be able to even say thanks to them. This is the labor of mourning. But the labor that also grows out of that trust that I mentioned, that faith, that fundamental definition of what the Christian faith is all about, that no act of love will ever be lost. And I think that's what they did. They were not expected to see anything, and we know from the gospel narratives that they were utterly surprised and afraid, scared to death by the experience that totally surpassed all that they were expecting. They were expecting just to pay their tribute to that, to the beloved one who had been killed. So this is the other aspect, and I think that's what constitutes the practice of resurrection, the capability of moving in the darkness of a Friday through the Eastern, to the light of an Eastern morning. We wouldn't be able to say, certainly we cannot establish any causal relationship between the cross and the practice of those women. We cannot say that it was because those women went out to prepare the ointment and the spices to anoint the dead body of Jesus that the resurrection happened. But as a matter of fact, we cannot say that it would have happened, or that we would know that it had happened, if it weren't for those women. Right? And I think that's rather important, and it's a point that's not enough emphasized sometimes, that we would, without those stories of the women that went and saw the physically empty tomb, we would not have any account of the resurrection. We would have accounts of the apparition of Jesus. And this is something else. We could have accounts of Jesus appearing to the disciples as it happened. We could have accounts of Jesus appearing to Paul as it happened, but these are apparitions, are not testimonies of the resurrection of a body, of the resurrection of a dead body. So if we cannot say that there is a causal relationship between the women preparing the spices to anoint the body, we can also say that it wouldn't have happened, or we would know that it had happened in the way in which we know it happened, if it were not for that labor of mourning, a labor of love, a practice of resurrection. So it is because of Jesus' because Jesus' body was raised, and because of the testimony, the witness of the women that have told it, because they have seen the empty tomb and Jesus coming to them, that we can speak also now of the raising of bodies. Of the raising of bodies, both in this life, in the midst of our own reality, as in the hereafter as well. So it's this physical aspect that grants to the Christian message this powerful content that says those who are downtrodden, they will raise. And they will raise here and now and hereafter as well. So it's not only any spiritual resurrection that could be something hardly more than a psychological uplifting, but it's in fact not the raising of a disembodied soul, but a body that has been downtrodden, oppressed, killed, assassinated, executed in a cross. So these two aspects of the cross, the one that says that that it expresses the condemnation that the cross represents, and the other that says, well, this is what has raised this labor of mourning and the practice of resurrection in a labor of love as well, that constitutes this reversal, this basic reversal that's so central to the biblical literature as much as it is to the story of the cross itself. So however, when we look at the resurrection, we should also be careful not to fall into what Douglas John Hall calls resurrectionism, right? Resurrectionism for him is this concentration in the glory of the resurrection without seeing the cross as being a fundamental scandal that was there. I don't know if you have seen, there are some crucifix that were, they are quite famous pictures. There are sculptures that pictures of them have been used in covers of books quite frequently, person crying out with a huge mouth, real invisible pain, the body all broken down. I don't know if you have seen some of these pictures. They were done, there are a number of sculptures that have done that in Latin America, but I'm reminded of one of them that has done hundreds of these sculptures with different aspects, but always showing Jesus as this tortured person, common person. He was asked why he did all this crucifix in this way, showing this this painful human being in this last or the on the pit of his own existence. And this sculptor, his name is Guido Rocha, he said, well, I always thought that Christ represents the people, and I cannot draw a picture of Christ if I don't look at the people at the depth of what their existence is, in the moment of their greatest oppression. And so, and I think that's the other aspect that needs to be there together with the resurrection. The reversal needs to be there. The depth of the suffering is the only place out of which a labor of love leads one to the empty tomb. But as you know, not all of the disciples had the same experience. And I said this according to the Gospel of Mark is the story of the women. The other disciples, the ones that ran from the cross, that went away from the cross, did not fail to see Jesus, and we have a number of accounts, right? From already announced by the women. Well, go to the Galilee because he's going to meet you there. Right? So, even if they ran from the cross, they were given the possibility of witnessing the resurrection in Jesus. In Jesus' apparitions to them. So, doesn't it matter then whether one stays at the foot of the cross and is led by this labor of mourning and love to go to the Easter morning to find the empty tomb? Isn't it the easiest way around to avoid the cross as the disciples did and simply wait for Jesus to come to them without going to all that pain of recognizing that the Messiah is dead and buried in a tomb? I think there is an interesting way in which this apparition of Jesus, the coming of Jesus to the disciples, works almost in a reversed way as it worked for the women. The women go from the cross to the resurrection. The disciples, those who were not there at the foot of the cross, those who ran away from the cross, were not lost. They were given a chance. But the chance that they were given goes the other way around. They didn't stood there in face of that pain. They saw the resurrection, but then they had to go back to the cross. I gave already the example of the disciples in the road to Emmaus, in which all the explanations, all the hermeneutics, even by the great rabbi Jesus, didn't help them to understand anything, right? They had to see the broken body. But there is another story which is even more illustrative for this point that I want to make is the account of Jesus coming to the disciples when they are gathered together in Jerusalem in John 20. I think you remember. Let me just read it to you here briefly. John 20, 19 following. When it was evening on that day, the first day of the week, and the doors of the house where the disciples had met were locked for fear of the Judeans, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples rejoiced when they saw the Lord. Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, so I send you." When he had said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained." The interesting thing in this narrative is the clear affirmation that the resurrected body, when it presents itself for the disciples, it carries with it the marks of the cross. So the resurrected body has still the scars of that cross. And the scars of that cross are not only a reminder for the disciples of saying, oh yeah, he was the one that was really crucified. No, that's not really the point of it all. The point of the narrative, as far as I am able to interpret it, lies in the sending of Jesus, or in the greeting that he gives. He says, peace be with you. Well, probably he, as most of us normally also tend to understand peace as either as being being quiet, unperturbed, and or simply as a formality, like hi, good day, when you really don't mean it, right? And I think the disciples were more or less taking it like one of those conventional salutations. Peace be with you. And when he said that, the text says, well, everybody was happy and they rejoiced. The resurrected is here. Isn't that great? Yeah. And then Jesus, I think, as a rabbi, as a teacher, he knew one of the basic lessons for teaching. It's that repetition is the mother of learning, right? Jesus knew that, because when the disciples really get happy and say, well, Jesus is here, the resurrected one is here, and so everything now is okay. And then Jesus said, well, peace be with you. He repeats the lesson like, haven't you gotten it? Peace be with you. And then, in order to make sure that they get it, that they understand it, he translated to them, as my Father has sent me, I send you. So that's what peace here means. This is what the scars point to. Not a reminder of the cross of Jesus himself, but ascending out to face the scars of the world, the fear that had kept them inside of that building with the doors and windows shut. Right? So, for the disciples who were not there, who didn't do the road from the cross through the resurrection, the way for them to really recognize what the resurrection meant had to carry them now back to the crosses of the world, had to carry them back to the reality that they did not, that they were afraid to see and to meet, as afraid as they were of just standing there by the cross. Because, in fact, they could have been taken up and gotten in prison and even crucified for identifying themselves politically with that rebel that was hanging there. So I think there are these two movements that I was trying to put in a graphic form. If you haven't gotten it in one way, if you haven't done like the women, the few women that were there on the cross, in order to recognize the relationship that is between cross and resurrection, that moves to a labor of mourning, you need to practice the cross, moving from the recognition of the one who has appeared as a resurrected back to the cross itself. In a graphic form, you have the cross and the resurrection. Has its suffering aspect. That thing that was in a widow buried, if you don't weep, if you don't cry like Mary, right? Giving him as lost, the Easter morning will not come. This suffering aspect of the cross reveals itself in an act of love, or manifests itself in an act of love, the going out and preparing the spices and the ointment. This is what allows them to witness the raising of Jesus. While those who have seen the risen Jesus by the scars that are presented, the disciples are sent back to this, sent back to the crosses of this world. Peace be with you. Go out. Don't stay here inside. Go out and find where the suffering is so that you can understand, so that you can truly understand what the resurrection is all about. So this is a suggestion for reflection on the way in which the cross and the resurrection stand in relationship to each other. I could say one of those errors, the one that goes from the act of love to the witnessing of the raising of Jesus to the empty tomb. This is the empty tomb. Is the practice of resurrection that I called after. Those who have seen the risen Jesus as an apparition have to move to the realities of this world, the realities of suffering of this world. This we could call the practice of the cross. The two complement each other. Yes, Chris.
Well, I'm trying to place Douglas John Hall's critique of how North Americans kind of rejoice in the resurrection on that scheme, and it seems to me like he would say that we in North America, the middle class, basically comfortable folks in North America, are in the room and we see the risen Jesus and we're so happy that we miss the scars and we just want to stay there with him and feel good. And that he's kind of challenging us to, I'm just playing this out because I don't really know how it would go, but I like the schema. So I think I would say Hall is challenging us to see in the resurrected Jesus the scars and therefore the message to go out and discover the cross again, and to discover who is suffering again. Well, how does that strike you?
Yeah, I think it's a fair way of putting what Hall's intention would be, right? And but he is much more reluctant to say it openly, and I think it's a tactical reluctance on his part. I talked to him once and said, well, he would agree with that. He would not deny that. He would say, listen, if I say much about that, people are going to say that I'm giving up the radicality of the cross. So for tactical reasons, he doesn't want to even stress that, because that would come up as a sort of a disclaimer of his more radical criticism of resurrection itself.
The point is that we are going to do the suffering at one time in our life or in a period of time. And unless we face it straight on, we may have to then see it again at a later time in a different kind of manner. We have to, they say, pay the piper sometime. And kids, I work with kids, they try to continue to avoid that painful event of whether it may be the loss of a parent or other kind of thing, and continue to run from that, and yet will eventually have to meet it later on in their life. And if they are to resolve it, if they are to deal with it, to see a resurrection in themselves, they have to face that. I think that we too, if we don't face it right on, we eventually will have to do that, whether it be in corporate United States, somewhere along the line, we are going to feel the suffering too.
Yeah.
And I think this is very helpful to me because it gives this sort of cyclical, isn't the right word, but a dynamic relationship between the cross and resurrection that Oshie has just said, it comes up sooner or later, you approach the suffering, but also that wherever we begin, wherever our encounter with Christ is, leads us to the next thing. So we might begin with seeing the risen Christ, as Paul did. But immediately we move to the next, then we're taken back to the suffering, even as starting with suffering leads to resurrection, that it makes it harder for us to separate those and get stuck in one place or the other, either psychologically or sociologically. I was trying to think, how would you place people in this as a kind of typology? But your arrows make it hard to make it into a typology.
I'm trying to avoid, thanks, Diane. No, I'm trying to avoid the typology, really, because I think there are so many dimensions in which we experience also the cross and suffering in one's life that one cannot use one single matrix, for example, the social economic matrix, and say, well, suffer is only the suffer that has this social economic aspect linked to it. Although I do recognize how this dramatic that kind of suffering is, I'm not ready to place it over against some psychological form of suffering or some physical forms of suffering due to illness and things like that. And I think they are also the cross and the raising of the body are the two things that someone said something yesterday after the class that was like I heard it being said before. Almost in the same way, we cannot think, that was more or less, I'm trying to remember the words, but it was more or less like that, we cannot think about suffering as being something opposed to happiness or joy, right? The two of them, in their, put it another way, in the depth of suffering itself, you can be joyful. And you can recognize this the joy that emerges out of this reality. So the two are not contradictory concepts, and so they are there together, and the reversals are present there.
Yeah, I guess I'd want to hear you talk about Thomas wanting to touch those wounds. How would you put that into what you said? The simplistic thing is to say he just wants to identify that it's really that same Jesus. But in this model, maybe there's something more to it.
Yeah. How does it go? Unless
I see the wounds, I won't believe it.
But it's Jesus who tells him to touch, right?
Yeah.
It's Jesus who tells him to. Jesus tells him to touch. Yeah, I think the. Yeah, it's an interesting. I have thought about that passage a number of times because it's interesting that what Thomas needs by not being there the first time that Jesus appears, right? He was probably taking a course of theology on that Sunday that Jesus appeared to them. So the next week he is there again and said, "Well, I need to see." And then Jesus comes again to appears again among them. But the need to see that the scars of Jesus, I think that's one of the things that really lift up the importance of the way in which Thomas, skeptical and critical as he was, he wanted and he understood. I wouldn't take this as a criticism of Thomas, but actually he understood the need to connect the one who has been there on that cross with the resurrected one, right? And so for Thomas, and it's not by chance that in the Christian tradition, in the legends of the Christian tradition, it's Thomas that's going to go more than any other apostle to the corners of the world. So he is, he going to India, and there's rich traditions that he has gone into India and evangelized India, as he has gone to Latin America. Mm-hmm. He walked over water, and that's the interpretation that people had, that Jesus said that the disciples would, according to John, Jesus said that the disciples would do even greater things. So there are a number of accounts of Thomas going to Latin America, and it's completely another story, but it's very interesting that these accounts are there, and they associate Thomas with really the one who reaches out and goes to the corners of the world. So instead of just saying, well, he's the skeptical, I think he had the right question.
Yeah.
I think he had the right question.
You know, go ahead.
What happens to the women after the resurrection then? I mean, do we go back through this? Do they return to the suffering? Does this end at the resurrection, or what is this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know.
they
came out of the suffering. The point in the narrative is they have gone through it, and that's presumably they knew already what this practice was. And they knew that that was the way in which it would have to continue. The problem is that we have so much, it's so much oblivion about the role of the women after that, mm-hmm. that we don't know. And this is one of the things that really is surprising. Well, it's not altogether surprising within a patriarchal culture, that the witnesses, that the apostles defined by being eyewitnesses to the resurrection were really second-hand witnesses to the resurrection, right? They saw Jesus, but not the empty tomb there. And why wouldn't the woman then constitute really the beginning of the apostolicity of the church, right? Which would be much more logical and consistent with the.
The criteria for apostolicity.
What?
And they're certainly sent to bear witness so that when they see the empty tomb, the response is to say something about it.
My question was, the apostles or the disciples were sent back to suffering, having run away from the cross and then seeing the risen Christ, but then being sent back to suffering. The women who came through the suffering and go to the resurrection, then do they also confront that suffering again?
The question is the end of the road when you recognize the raising empty tomb? So you either, as the woman, you either start with suffering, go to active love, and end up with rising empty tomb. Or as the guys, you start at riser, you're seeing the scars, going to suffering, down to active love, over to seeing the empty tomb.
It's a continuum, though, I think.
It doesn't stop.
You don't get a rest on your laurels when you're up there.
No. You make this movement here, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, but what happens is that as you gain wisdom, when you have suffering, you can't get yourself in too much of the suffering, because you know joy will come again in the resurrection. But if you're in the resurrection too, you also know that suffering will come and hit you again. Okay? So you have to, you take that with wisdom, you enjoy the moment, yet you also have the wisdom to realize that this is not over yet, you know, until life is over.
We can continue the, I know that you, but let me just let anyone who wants to go, because it's already time, so feel free to go, but please.
Would you talk a little bit more again about the suffering, how the suffering leads to an act of love? because they saw the suffering, they were, the woman got the picture there in terms of what the cross was about, and so they responded in an act of love. I can see how the act of love generates seeing resurrection, but help me again get the jump from suffering to the act of love.
From suffering to the act of love. I think the act of love, it starts not only in the preparing of the ointment and of the spices mm-hmm. for the body, but is the bearing the pain of being there. They didn't need to be there, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. you don't need to be there. Mm-hmm. You don't need to go there. You can avoid. I think we have been, our human condition is the one of trying to avoid mm-hmm. through one or another yeah. means yeah. being exposed to that which mm-hmm. reveals mm-hmm. the darkest side in our own self or in our own world, right? So the simple fact of being there is the beginning of the act of love, is the beginning of the practice of the resurrection. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the disciples were much more human, so to say. They reacted in a much more logical way. There's no point in being there. Wouldn't we say that too? Mm-hmm. What's the point of being there? The guy is dead or is going to die. Again, why are we going to have to go through that? It doesn't make sense, right? And the act of love is just the one of staying there mm-hmm. and not avoiding it. It's almost a repetition of the story of the Good Samaritan, right? Mm-hmm. You don't need to stop there. Let's pass by, right? But why it's only an act of love when you don't expect anything back, but with that belief that love is never lost,
it's
that faith, makes you stand
there. It's faith there. That
exactly.
is the line
exactly,
between suffering
yeah.
and the act of love. It's faith, realizing that no act of love is lost for whatever reason, without retribution. So that issue there is faith.
Yes.
I'm wondering, on the other side, is the raising of the empty tomb and the risen, is there, what is that? Is there faith in there, too?
I'd have some friends who'd say so. I usually discount them a lot, but I would know some people who would say, if you can't stay in the resurrection, it's because your faith weakened.
Say it again.
That's interesting.
Say it again.
If you can't stay in the resurrection, it's because your faith weakened.
Hmm.
I discount them most of the uh-huh. almost all the time, but
I would see it as I like what Osa has been saying about in terms of a perpetual cycle. I mean, it's not a matter of staying any one place. I mean, I wouldn't want to put myself in any one place,
sure, yeah.
but trying to see it as maybe within the span of a day, running the entire cycle. I want to also go back.
Yeah, it could be a spiritual exercise. Right?
Yeah. I mean,
it's called bipolar.
I want to go back and pursue your question a little further. Can you, if you're working with people and situation, can you, or what can you do to, should we say, help people in a cross realization or realization of that, so that they, yeah, of the suffering. I mean, I know you can't plan someone's suffering life, right? And they come at various times, and basic life itself is going to show up someplace along the line in terms of this suffering thing. But is there, is the very preaching of the cross, or the preaching of Jesus, is that itself the best way, perhaps, in terms of confronting someone with the suffering, with keeping suffering in the midst of all this? Though we live on the other side, we live on the empty tomb side, I mean, now historically and all this other kind of stuff, but if this piece is essential, which I really agree, to seeing resurrection, to really realizing the power of what resurrection is, which is to move us to suffer, and vice versa. But how do you help someone if you're in a situation, or do you simply let life go, you let their life run itself out, and along the way, when they hit suffering, at that point, if you're in relationship, to come alongside and said, now, to be in this is to help also see the resurrection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's
See, I think it's
wisdom, yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's an individual responsibility in suffering too, to understand what that suffering is.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that, hey, you know, I'm suffering because of something, and that it's okay, in some way I can stay here.
Yeah.
But I think it's also our responsibilities as Christians to have this faith of the act of love too,
mm-hmm.
that there is an external source where we give to other individuals who are in suffering, and that's our response to that. But there is another response of the individual in the suffering to try to understand that suffering and the meaning that it has.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, because I don't think it can be one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
The women, when the women brought the spices, it was not helping someone.
Mm-hmm.
It was an adoration of God.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
the very first commandment, love the Lord your God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good, yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the act of love really is all about. You don't do it because you want to get something back. I mean,
right.
They wouldn't get anything back from that.
You know, just to give you an example, I've been in concentration camps during the Second World War, okay? There is a response that you have to do as an individual, too, to understand that experience and say, hey, what have we learned from this? Hey, I'm going to get educated, right? Because they can take all the physical stuff away from you. Hopefully, they won't take your mind away from you. I suppose they can do that, too, but they can't do that. So education becomes an important thing. But there's an enormous gift of others too, who have helped you during that journey too. And so you come out of that suffering from acts of love, okay, by other individuals, as well as from your own act of love of yourself, not to degrade yourself, but to start doing self-care and dealing with that and coming out. So it's the responsibility of both individuals, yourself, as well as those Christians around you who have the faith to believe that this is the right thing to do. You do come to a resurrection, you begin to believe, oh, my gosh, you know, there is hope and we can get out of this, okay? But there are still scars that are left within you from that experience, and you do feel that. And you do feel the suffering, you begin to understand the suffering of others too, and you then have to give that kind of thing to the individual. I mean, I'm a psychiatrist, so when you also have to give that strength to the individual to grapple something that they have within themselves in order to garner that and say, what are your resources, as Jody says, you know,
yeah.
in this whole community building stuff, not what have you lost, which many people are looking for.
Yeah.
Look at all the bad things that have happened to me. The Native American people will tell me, well, it's because of prejudice. And I says, yes. And so what are you going to do about it, right? What are your gifts that you have? So you have to empower them as well as give them the act of love too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's a multiple kind of way and a multiple responsibility that individuals have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.